A couple of people during the retreat, and this was kind of advice that was in some ways very suitable for some people who were, you know, maybe the 10th or 12th day of the retreat, and their mind was quite settled, and they needed in some ways to be encouraged to look a little more carefully at kind of widen the scope of what they noticed when they did the mindfulness practice in the context of being somewhat stabilized in the practice. But I want to see how I elaborate on it a little bit. Now, as I think many of you know, most of you know, that mindfulness practice, or vipassana, is a practice of bringing everything into the light of consciousness. Everything that exists for us, every experience we can have, is brought into the light of our awareness when we do mindfulness practice. And we try not to let anything in our experience be outside of the field of awareness. And one of the great kind of joys that I had, or one of the great kind of moments of kind of like a realization that I had in this practice, was when I realized that anything that I experienced, I could be aware of. And that maybe it sounds kind of funny to hear that. Maybe it's either obvious or sounds strange, but to realize that anything that you can experience, anything, whether it's a thought or feelings or emotions or anything, can be included within the sphere of awareness practice, of noting it. And when I realized that, it was like suddenly I realized the possibility for freedom. It was like kind of a foretaste of what the complete freedom would be like. So what we're trying to do is to bring everything, all our experience, within the light of awareness practice. And it's very easy to leave certain things outside of that light, to leave certain things outside of that scope. And so, during the retreat, I told a couple of people about a story from The Wizard of Oz, which is when finally they make it to the Emerald City, and they go into the inner chamber of the wizard, if you remember. There's, I forget what's in the wall, but some big face or mask on the wall, is that what it is? And this big kind of, some kind of voice, big booming voice is kind of speaking majestically to them. And then the dog kind of runs over to the corner and pulls aside the curtain. And suddenly you realize it wasn't this big, majestic, whatever, emperor, but it's just this little puny guy who's pulling all the levers. And this is a little bit, I think, what we need to do in our meditation practice sometimes, is to look and see what's behind the curtain. Because often what's behind the curtain isn't being acknowledged or seen. And we don't acknowledge or see something, you can't really take responsibility for it, or you can't really be involved in changing it so much. And so an example of this, what's kind of what's behind the curtain perhaps, a very simple kind of cute example, is if you're sitting in your meditation and you're very quiet and mind is very still and quiet, and you can have this thought in the back of your mind, a very subtle thought, you can have this thought, and the thought can be, I'm not thinking anything right now. And you really believe it. And there can be this ongoing commentary in the back of the mind about how there's no thoughts at all. And it's such a very subtle. That's one of the reasons why it's difficult to see. But there's a way in which there's a realm of our experience, accessible experience. It isn't really the unconscious. It's an accessible part of our experience, which is kind of outside of the sphere of the light of what we're paying attention to. It's kind of behind the curtain. Another example is for meditators, especially I think on retreat, I think it's true in any area of life though, is has to do with performance anxiety. And the judgment and evaluation that we have about our practice, we don't realize that that also should be inside, on stage, within the arena of our awareness practice. And so often enough, people will be judging their practice in this subtle kind of back corners of the mind, kind of backstage, saying, oh, my practice is really good right now, you know, I'm really quiet, or, oh, I'm really a lousy meditator, this is not working for me, and oh, you know, I just, you know, if I can go get some tea, I can come back and things will be better. And all this kind of judgment and scheming that could be about the meditation is often not included as part of what we pay attention to, what we're aware of, what we note. And it's very important to pull the curtain and notice that, because it's happening and it's kind of directing the show often. And one example, I think another kind of cute example, So I had to open my eyes periodically when I was sitting there in front of everybody during the retreat, because I'm the timekeeper ringing the bell. So then I would notice, I'd open my eyes, and I'd notice that people who are kind of within the, close by occasionally, would be going like this. You know, kind of checking on the time to make sure that, you know, I don't know why, I don't know what they were, you know, making sure I hadn't fallen asleep, or make sure that, I don't know what they were checking. But what I assume is that the kind of restlessness, the kind of concerns about the time and the period coming to end, was not included in what they paid attention to, what they noted, what they were aware of. They're trying to be aware of their breath, their body, their posture as they meditate. But the fact that they started getting restless and impatient or something, I suspect often isn't included, because that's not considered to be technically part of what meditation is about. And technically there's nothing which is not meditation. But we often leave things outside, in the backstage or whatever. I speak kind of under conjecture for the people I saw, but I know that I've done that. Gotten impatient near the end of a sitting, and somehow thought the impatience had nothing to do with the meditation practice. I didn't note it. So these are often kind of, can be called the blind spots, and we need to notice. Part of what we need to notice at times is what we're not noticing. And in mindfulness instruction, we're always told to kind of note what's actually happening. But sometimes it's necessary to kind of note what you're not noticing, because it's also happening. And I want to underscore that it doesn't necessarily mean becoming aware of your unconscious. These are things which are quite accessible to awareness, but they're overlooked. And, you know, we easily overlook things in our daily life. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of externally. And it's very easy to overlook things in our mind or in our own inner experience. And one of the reasons it's important to become aware of all this is that what happens behind the curtain is often what directs our life. The director or the stage manager is behind the curtain, kind of, you know, giving instructions. And our unacknowledged assumptions, tendencies, needs, biases, these are the directors and the stage managers behind the curtain. And perhaps one of the most dramatic examples is addictions. People can be powerfully addicted to something and not really see that they're addicted. Alcoholics often will not see or deny or insist that they're not alcoholics. But, you know, there's a lot of strong tendencies towards cravings, maybe perhaps towards alcohol, which is going on behind this particular curtain. It's there, it's accessible, but it's being overlooked. And there's many things, you know, you can have your own list of what's behind the curtain that you could see if you pulled a curtain. The need for security or the need for approval can be directing much of the more public show of what's going on. And we might not notice that we're motivated by the need for security or the need for approval, but it defines much of who we are sometimes. And we need to learn to kind of turn the light of awareness to look also at that in addition. And it's interesting that for many people, I don't want to say for everyone, but it was certainly true for me when I started doing my meditation practice, when I started going on retreats. For many people on retreats, retreat is a time where the mindfulness and the mind becomes attentive enough, quiet enough, attentive enough to begin seeing some of the underlying levels of what's going on in the mind. Or some of the curtains are pulled back. Agitation is one of the curtains. So if you stop becoming so agitated that you pulled away a curtain and you see something kind of behind it. And sometimes what you find, many things, it can be a surprise what you find. It can be great capacities for joy and love and compassion and for silence, which maybe you didn't even know you had, but it's there behind a particular curtain. But it could also be other things. And one of the things that often people notice at the beginning of starting to do retreats is an underlying level of fear or guilt. And it's fairly common for people to be quite surprised, see, oh, there's all this fear which is underlying everything that I do. It's very, very quiet and quiet maybe and subtle. And in the subtlety, it's not seen. But it's there directing it. And when you become in the retreat, there's a time where you can become aware of the subtle mind. And it's fascinating because, I mean, I've noticed in my early retreats, some of the themes for me was fear and guilt. And you start becoming aware of how it directs not only the gross activities, but even such perhaps subtle things as how you sit or how you stand or how you walk or how you eat can be in some ways directed by or controlled or affected by some of these underlying things like fear or guilt. And the Buddhist tradition, I think the Buddhist tradition recognizes the great power that these directors, the stage managers, have behind the curtain when it puts when it emphasizes the role of ignorance. There are three main causes of suffering in the Buddhist tradition. And it's kind of often you kind of rattle it off as one word when kind of come by rote: greed, hate, and delusion, or greed, hate, and ignorance. And often people talk a lot about greed and hate, but ignorance is often overlooked. And ignorance doesn't necessarily mean the absence of knowing, but it means it can also mean the ignoring of things. And when you realize how powerful an effect ignored aspects of our life have in causing suffering, in causing fear, or causing hate, or causing anger and anxiety, you begin understanding how important this this quality or this aspect of ignorance is in the Buddhist tradition. And one of the things we're trying to overcome is the limitations of ignorance, limitations of greed, hate, and ignorance. So the word for ignorance in Sanskrit is avidya, and vidya means knowledge, and a is not, so non-knowledge. But I think another way of translating it is the unrecognized. The unrecognized can be a great source of limitation for our life. Carl Jung apparently said, that which we do not bring to consciousness appears in our life as fate.
Say again?
That which we do not bring to consciousness appears in our lives as fate. And so I'm trying to say in the beginning that what's behind the curtain isn't necessarily unconscious, but I don't quite know what the unconscious is even. But it's there's maybe an overlap, and you can kind of over them, there's kind of shared areas between what I'm talking about and the unconscious. But Freud, who was the one who kind of threw the unconscious into the public consciousness, public discourse. He talked a lot about the different ways in which ignorance or the ignoring or the unrecognizing happens, the way in which we kind of can train ourselves or to avoid being aware of things. And he talked about such things as, I think, as far as I know, he's the one introduced in a way, a very important way, the word, the concepts of like denial and projection and repression, defense, rationalization, all these kinds of ways in which we use to avoid looking at what's maybe behind the curtain. So the process of mindfulness at certain points, certain periods of our practice, becomes the process of becoming aware of the curtains themselves. And then the curtains maybe is a little bit of a bad analogy, because curtains, in order to see behind it, you usually have to pull them apart, you know, kind of remove them from the stage. And it isn't necessarily we're getting rid of anything when we do mindfulness practice, but what we're doing maybe is making the curtains transparent, so they no longer obscure our vision and we see what's behind it. But we become aware of the curtains that we've erected, and in a sense we either see through them or we start pulling them back. And so, for example, a person could be angry. And if you really are present for the anger and get to know it well, at some point you see maybe the anger is a kind of a curtain for something else. And you see that behind that curtain there's fear. So you try to become aware of fear really well. You get to know that, become an expert on your fear. And then behind the fear you see there's insecurity. And then you get to know that and you pull that curtain apart, and there's a kind of maybe, I don't know, a sense of vulnerability. And then you pull that curtain apart And what happens? You just keep pulling curtains back. And then you keep pulling them back and back and back until there's nothing behind them anymore. And it's kind of like, you know, I think these movies or cartoons where these characters are like on the 40th floor of an apartment building or a skyscraper, and they're opening a series of doors, and then suddenly they open a door, and that door opens straight out to the outside. It's kind of like that. You know, you keep pulling back the curtains, and suddenly, and then, you know, it can be kind of scary to be there in looking out into space. And then I thought of this movie, I think it's called The Wings of Desire. And I saw the preview for the sequel. And this, in the previews, I think, there's these angels in Berlin who are kind of, they're sitting on top of a monument, some high monument in the middle of Berlin. And they're kind of talking and looking at what's going on below. And at some point, they kind of stand up and just kind of step forward. And you kind of think, well, they're, you know, going to fall. I didn't realize they were angels until they kind of, the angle of the camera changes and you see that they're flying. There's no problem at all. And I don't know where this is from, but I found this. Someone says, come to the edge. And the others say, no, we will fall. Come to the edge. No, we will fall. So they came to the edge and he pushed them. And they flew. So we keep opening the curtains and opening the curtains. And at some point, you might find yourself without anything behind the curtains anymore, except vast space, vast spaciousness. And at some point, it becomes your experience, your awareness or your consciousness becomes a form of consciousness which does not alight anywhere, which does not get caught anywhere, doesn't get hung up anywhere. And it's so easy, I think, for our awareness to alight or get caught or get hooked by different things. So, for example, if a person is very thirsty, that person will maybe only see the drinks in the room because the awareness is being directed or selected, is hung up on drinks. And, you know, that's... or someone who's afraid a lot, who feels very insecure, they might only pick up the things in the environment which are threatening to them, whether it's real or not, because somehow their awareness is not free, but is selected or been hooked or been narrowed or limited in some way, in some direction. So what happens at some point is we can experience the possibility of having an unselected consciousness, a consciousness that does not get limited, still aware of everything, but it doesn't get hooked by anything. It doesn't get stuck anywhere. And the experience of things being stuck, of being hooked, in some ways, kind of like this consciousness grasping stuff, can be experienced in the body. And it was kind of very interesting that some of the people on the retreat talked about how at some point they could feel what grasping was like in their body. They could feel that whenever their mind or their consciousness or their awareness was grasping at something, or holding onto something, getting stuck, often that translated was expressed in a kind of subtle graspings in the body. And it's very possible, if you're aware of your body, to be aware of this kind of grasping in the hands. If you only paid attention to what your hands did for 7 days, for a week, your hands might reveal a lot. Some of you might have noticed that often I'm sitting up here and I'm holding something. And I don't know quite why, but maybe I'm a little bit nervous, or I don't know why I'm holding, you know, playing with something while I'm talking to you. But what's going on with my hands? It can happen in the body, in the stomach. But interestingly, it can also happen in the brain. And the brain often is like a muscle. Sometimes you can feel the brain itself kind of grasping or holding on. So you have to remember that what's behind the curtain in the blind spots of our experience, inner experience, is often still operating. The fact that it's behind the curtains doesn't mean it's kind of resting between shows. It's often very much operating. And there's many, it's a whole fascinating talk to exploration to discover what's behind the curtain and still operating. Such things as assumptions. Many assumptions can be kind of blind spots. And it's been pointed out by many, I think, Buddhist teachers that the assumptions that I'm not okay or that I'm not complete or I'm not an acceptable person, is an assumption which can be so ingrained in us that maybe it's so ingrained we don't see it, it's hidden, or it's so ingrained that it's kind of opaque or something, or we just kind of see right through it, we don't really notice that it's there. It occurred to me this thing about we have a culture which is neurotic about body weight. And the people's body weight, what's appropriate, what's accepted, or changes, you know, every decade. But it's so much taken for granted, the assumption of what is a proper body weight, that people will spend millions, billions of dollars in our culture based on an assumption which isn't questioned. And then there's a quote by Krishnamurti. The evil of our time is the loss of consciousness of evil. The evil of our time is the loss of consciousness of evil. Maybe that's the greatest evil of our time, when we no longer notice all the awful things that are happening around us. We turn ourselves off from it. When I was sitting my first retreat in Thailand, a number of the important experiences I had there, very important experiences, in some ways had nothing to do with my own meditation practice. Sometimes that's the way it works. And you have to be there doing the meditation practice and being on retreat, and you think that's what's going on. And really the important things are happening when you're not meditating. I shouldn't say that, I'm a meditation teacher. I had the kind of personality that maybe kind of fearful personality, was kind of insecure and always wanted to kind of fit and follow the program and not kind of be very, tend to be compliant. So here I was, and I come from almost 5 years or more, I think, at a Zen center, Zen monasteries, where it's, you know, really strict discipline. So I came to this monastery in Thailand, which was kind of like a dog patch, kind of this total anarchy. And there was like this world's biggest pig would be wallowing around, and you know, and all these dogs, and everything was a mess and dirty, and everybody did whatever they wanted, and it was anarchy. It was, you know, a great place. And a very wonderful teacher, I respected a lot, and I was told, I was given this little hut, nice little cute little hut on Kuti, on stilts with a porch. And I'd sit there most of the time, sitting, and then behind the porch was someone's grave. And so I'd sit in my porch, and then I'd go out and do the walking meditation back and forth across the grave. And I was supposed to do this an hour a day, each of those for an hour, all through all day long. And that sitting hour for an hour, walking for an hour, sitting an hour, walking an hour. And a few times a day I was supposed to go have my meal, or once a day I was supposed to have my interview. So it was very clear what I was supposed to be doing. And if I wasn't having an interview or eating or bathing or washing my clothes, something, you know, very practical is happening right in my hut, I was supposed to be meditating. So one day, I don't know what the reason was anymore, but one day I walked around the monastery. And I was kind of walking away from my hut and just walking kind of around. And horrors to horrors, comes walking is the abbot. You know, he sees me. I'm not doing a meditation practice. I was kind of wandering around, strolling around. What had such a big impact on me was that we're kind of walking like this, perpendicular to each other, kind of passing each other at some distance, but not too far away. He saw me, and he saw me in such a way that there was no judgment evaluation of what I was doing. Or there was no, it was like almost like I was like just part of the landscape, a neutral part of the landscape. And I knew that if I went up and talked to him, if I needed him or anything, he knew I was there, he would have talked to me, he was happy. But he had no judgment, no expectations, no evaluations, just, oh, there's this person. And I felt kind of like this, like a landscape, and I felt kind of liberated in a small way. Now, I realize maybe this is a strange kind of thing to say, because in our culture, some people feel like wallpaper, and it's kind of the same thing. You know, they feel like no one sees them. It wasn't that. I felt like I was really seen. In some ways, I felt I was seen really for the first time in a very true way. I was completely seen, but I was completely seen outside of all categories of anything, of being a meditator, of following a schedule, of anything. And I felt in a small way kind of liberated by this guy, because he saw me. It was like the first time I felt someone really saw me, even though in a way he didn't see me. Does this make sense? I felt totally acknowledged in some ways. So in some ways, it was the experience of being on the receiving end of someone's consciousness or awareness, which was not getting hung up anywhere, not being limited by anything. So this consciousness, or this awareness that is not caught by anything, not limited by anything, is known in the Buddhist tradition as an unsupported consciousness, unsupported awareness. It's kind of when all the curtains are, maybe when all the curtains are pulled back, or when all the curtains are seen through, and there's no more any directors supporting the cast. This is an unsupported consciousness. And the Buddhist tradition likens it to a ray of light, which is moving through space and doesn't hit any walls or any objects at all. And that's what that consciousness is like. It doesn't, in some ways, it kind of doesn't hit anything. It doesn't get caught anywhere. It's kind of this completely unobstructed experience of consciousness. And it's said that as the curtains kind of get seen through, or as the curtains get pulled apart, as you approach this experience of the unsupported consciousness, the mind becomes, it said in the text, it said, the mind becomes pliable, flexible, and manageable. Isn't that kind of nice? And in order to keep pulling back the curtains, or at least to be able to keep the curtain pulleys rust-free, it's very important to have a daily meditation practice. I think daily meditation practice, maybe it's kind of like the lubricant on those pulleys and the ropes that pull the curtains back and forth. So what is this unsupported consciousness? So I was thinking, when I was thinking about this, it occurred to me that there are such things as aging. Buddhism talks a lot about sickness, old age, and death. There is such things as aging. But aging, we're not going to deny it. That's like putting up in the curtain. But aging doesn't get a foot in the door of the mind. Aging is an event which doesn't in which the consciousness doesn't have to get hooked by or caught by. Aging doesn't have to color consciousness. And perhaps this experience of unsupported consciousness, in consciousness itself, in attention or awareness itself, such categories as aging, sickness, old age, death, simply don't apply in that world. Those things happen, but they don't apply to consciousness. And I wonder, do you agree with that? Does consciousness or presence, the sense of presence we have anything to do with change, or anything to do with aging, or even with death? Does consciousness, with this unsupported consciousness, have anything to do with death? Is there dying in unsupported consciousness? The Buddhist tradition, I think, or has said, focuses a lot on impermanence. And it's almost as if things like birth, sickness, old age, death, are kind of like fingers. It's like finger painting on water. That's as ephemeral as it is. So what happens if we're brave enough to pull back all the curtains? To pull back all the curtains. Sorry? Trust. It requires a lot of trust to do that. Now, Jack Kornfield says that sometimes when people kind of begin having some kind of experience of living in more unsupported consciousness, they start floundering or kind of start kicking around or getting afraid. And he makes the example that it's like learning to swim. And when you first put in the water, you don't believe the water will hold you up. and you kind of trash about and you probably drown. But at some point you learn you can trust that the water will hold you up, and what you learn to do is relax into the water. At some point we learn to relax into the experience of unsupported consciousness, trust into it. Does this make sense to you? What are some of the things that are behind the curtains that are are accessible but are overlooked? Yes.
It's not an answer to your question, but could I ask you?
Oh yeah, sure.
In your experience of unsupported consciousness, have you found yourself going in and out?
Oh, it's nothing is permanent.
What happens when you go out? Can you feel that happen?
Sure. You can feel very tangibly what it's like to get hooked. What it's like to grasp onto things. And one of the values, this is kind of the opposite of what people think. But what we're interested in, one of the things that we're interested in Buddhism is wisdom, more than we're interested in calm, for example. And so calm can come from concentration. You get concentrated. But the wisdom, a lot of wisdom can happen as you exit from the experience of calm. Because you calm your mind, you calm all the constructions and ideas of the mind, all the directors kind of take a break. And then at some point the directors come back, or at some point the mind gets start getting caught up. And if the mind is calm, there's a possibility of seeing what that's like, feeling it in the body and seeing what happens. If we're living an agitated life and our mind is kind of busy all over the place, if one more director comes on stage, no one notices, because there's already 20 of them there.
There's no intention if there's not an option.
There's no intention if there's no option?
Yes, if I know I can't move, I mean my body might be just spasms, but the intention doesn't form to move it.
Oh. I suppose there's different levels to intention. There's the mental side of it, which can be quite strong. And sometimes you can't get the object of your intention, but the intention can be quite there. It's quite strong. If you're such a person who won't have any intentions, even when it's unobtainable, you're very lucky. So there can be a desire. It's kind of like a desire that's more than just simply a desire, but it's a desire you really want to do it. But then there's another kind of thing, which maybe what you're calling intention, what Joseph calls intention, is when the intention is then translated into a command to do something. And if you can't get your thing, then you're probably not going to translate it into action because the impulse, you can catch off, as the mind gets more subtle and attentive, you can catch some of those steps that lead up to moving.
Uh-huh. And when I'm very, very clear, there's no problem about it.
Yeah.
I just know that certain things are off limits, and there's no problem about wanting them. There's no.
Uh-huh. No. Yeah. It helps. It helps to be very clear of your intention. And one of the things that people are instructed to do as your mindfulness deepens, or you get more familiar with the mindfulness practice, is start becoming aware of intention, because intention is one of the biggest creates the biggest consequences in our life, maybe. So one of the biggest places that we create consequences that we have some control over, have some possibility of some freedom in the midst of. And some people would say that Buddhism is a religion that focuses on intention. It's so very, very important in the Buddhist tradition. And so understanding what our intention is clearly enough so you can get behind it can make a life a lot easier. Or to see the kind of intentions that might arise that want to pull us away from our primary intention. see it clearly enough so you're not caught by it, so you can stay on track. It is very important also. So starting to become aware. And so the intention maybe is like one of these things that can be behind the curtain. And becoming, bringing that into the forefront, center stage, is very, very useful. And intention gets, you know, it can get very, very, very subtle. Yes?
I'd like to understand a little bit better this whole picture that you painted.
On the water.
No, not I prefer one on a blanket. There's these curtains being drawn back, and there's a director behind the curtain. So that director kind of evaporates because...
It could.
Okay, well, that's what I'm asking.
A number of things can happen. One is, if you see something clearly enough, it could lose all its power over you, or you lose your identification with it, and you simply evaporate, like you said. But you better not have set that up as an expectation that's going to happen. Then you're asking for trouble. But the other thing that can happen is you can see it so clearly that by seeing it, it's still there, but it's not directing your life. So, for example, it's possible to get angry and see the anger so clearly that you're not acting or repressing or doing anything with the anger.
Okay. Well, what I'm getting at with what I'm asking is what ultimately does direct your life. Like, you pull back all these curtains and finally there's space, you know, and you're learning to swim and all of that. But, you know, what directs your life? Let's say you get to this point and all the curtains are pulled back.
Yeah.
And there's this empty. Then how do you say what?
Yeah, I think maybe, you know, to say you end up with nothing, because a great big empty nothing is maybe not quite accurate either. It's the experience of consciousness being unsupported. But that doesn't mean that there's still objects of consciousness. It doesn't mean that you're no longer experiencing the world. It means you're experiencing the world without getting caught by anything in the world. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, and so. That experience then is said to be one which, when the consciousness is quite open, our consciousness is completely open because it's unselecting. It's kind of choiceless. Another way of saying it is that it's an open heart, because consciousness and heart are closely connected. And even if you translate it to being an open-heartedness, then you feel connected to the world around you, the people around you. And part of the motivation to act then comes out of that sense of connectedness from others.
Okay, that answered my question. Because my question is going to be, what is the relationship between that sense of openness and compassion? It seems to me that's what Buddhism is.
Yeah, it's great to clear. So Buddhism doesn't, you know, since it's not a theistic religion, doesn't have any, divinely ordained intention you're supposed to have. But Buddhism is very shy of setting up absolutes. So, you know, it's like absolute morality or ethics of how you should live your life. But the criteria for decide how you're supposed to live your life in Buddhism is based on pragmatic criteria for what will help you attain certain goals. And there's two goals that the Buddhist tradition puts higher than all others. Doesn't mean that others... I don't want to put higher, that's maybe bad. Kind of Buddhism puts at the center of Buddhism, at least. And that is the intention to free consciousness, to have free consciousness. And the other is the intention of alleviating suffering in the world, compassion. And those two are intertwined. They can't really, they can be separated, but for most people they're intertwined. So then you're deciding what you can do in your life. You would decide, does this either help someone or myself become more free? Or does this help myself or someone else become free of more of suffering, or alleviate suffering? Yes?
I'm getting kind of stuck on the unsupported consciousness. Term. Does that mean there is supported consciousness?
Oh, yes.
And what would that mean?
Supported, the word, the Buddhist word could be translated also as... the literal translation of the word is not standing consciousness. And so unsupported is the most common English translation. Another translation, which maybe is better, is unestablished consciousness. it's consciousness or a frame of reference or awareness which is not established on any bias or tendency or needs or anything. In Buddhism, consciousness is very seldom, I don't know how to say this exactly, but consciousness is often colored or by or shaped or defined by intentions, desires, emotions, and mental states. And so for example, if you have a strong desire for ice cream, then consciousness is not, if consciousness then is, and you start looking everywhere for ice cream, then your awareness is being defined or being established on, your attention is being established on the need or the desire for ice cream. So that's a supported consciousness. It's supported by that desire. Does that make sense?
I think it's just my sense of what support means. You know, kind of, it seems like it's a positive term.
It could be.
Support.
Yeah.
So in this sense, it has a pejorative.
But you're a therapist, right? And I should apologize because last time I was here, I said something I shouldn't have said about therapy, and I felt bad about saying it afterwards. I just wanted to say it publicly. I felt bad. I could have said what I wanted to say in a more skillful way. But what happens often is that people, in California, are very sensitive to language, and often Buddhist language and therapeutic language share the same vocabulary, but with different meanings. So you have to be very careful to kind of listen to the Buddhists and not necessarily understand it the same way. So, and it's very important with such doctrines as self and no self and all that. So of course we should be supported in this. And Buddhism talks about, I could easily give a whole talk about how we need to be supported. But it's a different kind of support. It's an unsupported consciousness exists on a foundation of things like morality and loving kindness. So I don't know if that's a paradox or a contradiction.
Unsupported consciousness does have some support.
Yes.
What is the wisdom?
Wisdom. What does wisdom mean for you?
But in the context of the question earlier about what's guiding you in your life, the answer seems to pop into my mind that guidance comes from wisdom.
There's a number of different, wisdom can be a number of things. Some people, wisdom is just understanding very well the human life, human predicament, you know, our inner forces, our inner life, understanding it really well, and understanding the inner life of others, sometimes understood as wisdom. It's in Buddhism, sometimes wisdom is almost synonymous with insight, and it's understanding something about the underlying patterns or rules or laws of our experience. That our experience, all our experiences have certain fundamental aspects to the process of those experiences. So if you understand those in a very, very deep way, there's a kind of a wisdom there. So for example, if you have a very, very deep understanding, very deep penetration of impermanence, that's for Buddhism is wisdom. You see that everything is impermanent and changing. And part of the reason it's wisdom is that if you see it clearly enough, you're more likely to live from that place, live from that understanding, that there's nothing that you can hang on to, or nothing you can grasp, or nothing that you could ultimately rely on. And so you learn to trust. So you're supported by trust. Does that make sense at all? There are many definitions of wisdom. One that I like is the wisdom is the faculty or the function of non-identification with our experience. So we think of wisdom as being knowledge. But in Buddhism, wisdom isn't necessarily knowledge, but it's the capacity or the ability not to identify with anything in our experience.
My experience was So that's more than ignore, but at some point,
so that, so that's your experience.
Did you call it unsupported consciousness distorted consciousness?
No, not at all. Unsupported consciousness supported consciousness as distorted consciousness. I don't think I would want to use that word. It just doesn't feel right. I haven't thought about it.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the more I hear the word support, what it means to me is holding on to rigid beliefs, like in math, or I'm not sure exactly in logic, you would support an argument in a certain way, or you'd say, well, this supports the fact that the earth is flat. And then later on they found out that they, well, at least they believe now that it's round. And when you say unsupported, I think of freedom from rigid principles or beliefs.
So perhaps a fixed consciousness.
Fixed, yeah.
It works better. Because that feels kind of petrified to have a consciousness that's fixed. What we want to do is a consciousness which is flexible.
So I just wanted to say I like the term unconditioned.
How about conditioned?
That's a common one. Conditioned and unconditioned consciousness. That's also.
What's the Pali word for
unconditioned? It's about something like apatitta. Apatitta. Citta, something like that. Citta, the word citta in Sanskrit, citta is has an S, so it's citta. And citta, my guess, is closely related to our word stand, because it's a wonderful way in which English and Indo-European languages kind of come together, right? So it's a consciousness which doesn't stand anywhere. So I think we need to stop. Maybe last question.
How do you get to understand what your own intention is?
By paying attention. By paying careful attention to